Okay, good morning, everybody. This is about 2:31. It's November 5th, and we're going to finish up census and move into endocrinology today. And let's see, Monday, we got a lecture. Wednesday, we have a lecture. Then next Monday is a holiday. That's Veterans Day, so there's no school on Monday. And then we're going to have our third lecture exam on Wednesday, so a week and a half away for the next lecture exam. Materials in your study guides. Let's see what else. Oh, practicums this week. That's right. So the third practicum is this week, and then the third exam is next week. So nobody has a practicum and a lecture exam on the same day. Okay, any questions on the schedule? No, you're good. All right, so we were talking about the ear last time, and as a matter of fact, even more generally, we were talking about special sensation. What the heck is a special sense compared to a general sense? A special sense is one that you have perception just in one, maybe two locations on your body. And they're complicated organs that allow you that sensation. For instance, vision is a special sense because you can only see with your eyes. As opposed to temperature, that's a general sense because you can feel temperature all over your body. And you can feel pressure all over your body. And you have proprioception all over your body. But vision, hearing, gustation, and equilibrium senses are located only in very specialized organs. And we were talking about the ear. The ear has three senses, special senses associated with it. And just like there's three special senses, there are three parts to the ear. There's the external ear, the middle ear that contains the auditory ossicles, and the inner ear, which contains the labyrinth. And the inner ear right here is the part responsible for all three of those sensations. There is a bony labyrinth that contains the organelles for these different senses. The cochlea is the sense for hearing. And the vestibule is the sense for static equilibrium. And the semicircular canals produces the sense of what we call dynamic equilibrium or kinetic equilibrium or spinning, angular acceleration. While the vestibule right here is important for, we said, static equilibrium or linear acceleration. Okay. All right, I guess my microphone is still on. Sounds like it kind of died. But remember, sound enters the cochlea via the oval window, and it runs around inside the cochlea and leaves via the round window right here. So I think we talked about all this stuff last time, but maybe I just want to review just a little bit. Okay, so here is a pretty good example of the auditory ossicles and the tympanic membrane. The stapes vibrates the oval window, and that introduces sound waves into the scala vestibuli. And then that passes through the cochlear duct right here, depending on the size of the cochlear duct. And remember, this region out here called the helicotrema, this is the widest part of the cochlea. Kind of looks like the smallest part, but this is actually the widest part. So this is the part that vibrates at the lowest frequency, just like the biggest string on a guitar. The thickest string vibrates at a low frequency. Same thing for pianos. And you should even think of this thing as a piano. Right, low frequencies vibrate here, mid-range frequencies here, high-pitched frequencies will vibrate this part of the cochlear duct. And when it does, that energy moves across, okay, into the scala tympani and then exits out the round window. And you should be aware of the organ that's in the cochlear duct right here. And here I can see a bunch of cochlear ducts that spiral around in through the cochlea. So let's zoom into this region, just one region. So here is that scala vestibuli on the top, scala tympani on the bottom, the cochlear duct in the middle, and sound is going to move across from the vestibuli into the tympani. And when it does, it vibrates the tectorial membrane. And when the tectorial membrane vibrates, let's go to the next slide. So here's the tectorial membrane. It's going to bend these stereocilia on these hair cells. So the hair cell is the receptive cell for sound, only in one part of the cochlea. And then these nerves will take these action potentials or nerve impulses up to the primary auditory cortex in the brain, which is in the temporal lobe and causes stimulation, which then you will have the appreciation of sound when these action potentials reach there. All right, so this is in the bony labyrinth called the cochlea, and the membranous labyrinth is called the cochlear duct, and the cells that actually pick up these vibrations are what we call hair cells. All right, so let's look at the other parts of the labyrinth. All right, maybe I'll go, let me go back to this slide over here, this one right here. All right, this is even a better slide. So here we can see the cochlea, and here's the thick part out by the helicotrema. All right, so we're done talking about the cochlea. Let's talk about the vestibule. And the vestibule has an organ called the macula, and there are two of them, maculae. There's a utricle and saccule. And you're going to see that it's sort of similar to the cochlear duct in that there are hair cells. These are the receptor cells with stereocilia poking up off the top of them, and then that can stimulate these vestibular nerves. Right, but the receptor cell is a hair cell. The stereocilia poke up into a gelatinous mass right here. Right, so that when the gelatinous mass is pushing straight down on the stereocilia, they don't bend. But as soon as you tilt your head, this gelatinous mass gets pulled on by gravity, because embedded in this gelatinous mass are these little crystals of calcium carbonate called otoliths. These act as little weights, and that pulls the gelatinous mass down, and that deforms the stereocilia, and that sets up action potentials in the vestibular nerve that are going to go to your brain and will give you the sense of linear acceleration or static equilibrium. Okay, so here you can see that gelatinous mass, the otolith membrane, otolith on top, and if you were to tilt your head forward, that would deform the stereocilia, and you would know what position your head is in. Right, and they would bend the opposite way if your head were to bend backwards, and so you would know exactly what position your head is in. All right, so the two organs responsible for this are the utricle and saccule. And what about the receptor cells? I see them right here. What are the receptor cells? They're hair cells, just like in hearing. All right, that's kind of strange. All right, so the exact same mechanism has been employed for a totally different kind of sense, and you get the different sense because these nerve impulses go to a different part of the cerebrum. If these nerve impulses were to go to the auditory cortex, then when you would bend your head, you would actually hear something. But that's not where these signals go. These signals go to a part of the brain responsible for equilibrium. And the question is, what kind of equilibrium does the utricle and saccule provide for us in the vestibule? So right here, what is this sense right in this region right here? Static equilibrium, or maybe you should say linear acceleration. Static equilibrium and linear acceleration are the same. All right, so that only leaves one other part, and that are the semicircular canals. And there's fluid on all these different parts of the ear, including the semicircular canals. So let's look at the base of one of the semicircular canals. That's called an ampule, right? Because it reminded somebody of a little glass vial. And since this is a nice circle right here, fluid can actually flow in a circle if you start spinning or stop spinning. That endolymph can actually flow through these semicircular canals, and notice that they're oriented in three different planes. Like here's a transverse plane, here's a sagittal plane, here's a coronal plane. So you can have a good sense of any of those dimensions that you are spinning in. So let's look inside the ampule. All right, and here's the ampule. Here is another gelatinous mass, but this one is what we call the cupula. And embedded in the cupula are these hair cells. You're familiar with hair cells from the cochlear duct and also from the maculae. And when this fluid starts to flow, it will push on the cupula here and will bend the stereocilia. For instance, when you start spinning or stop spinning, then these hair cells will initiate action potentials in the vestibular nerve, which then take it to the spinning part of your brain. And probably some of you have played with this system maybe even as recently as last night or maybe even this morning, because what's a favorite trick that a lot of people like to do, especially kids? Like our age. You like to spin and then stop all of a sudden, open your eyes, and you look at the world, and what is the world doing? Even though you're stopped, what's the world doing? It's still kind of spinning around you because this endolymph, right, was spinning at the angular rate or angular velocity that you were spinning at, and then all of a sudden if you stop, this fluid still starts to flow through the semicircular canals and it pushes on the cupula and it gives you this sensation, that weird sensation that you're spinning. Because this endolymph right here really has a property of mass called inertia. Right, so this endolymph, since it has inertia, it just means that when it's stationary, it likes to stay put. Another example of inertia is that once matter starts to move in a particular direction and the force is removed from it, it likes to continue in that same direction. So for instance, when you're driving in your car and you hit the accelerator and you get to 60 miles an hour, as soon as you take your foot off the gas pedal, what does your car do? Does it stop immediately? No, it continues on until friction kind of bleeds away some of that energy. So the car likes to keep going in the direction it was going in for a certain period of time. Same thing for this endolymph right here. So we could do a little experiment to kind of show this. All right, so let's just say that, okay, what's moving is going to be endolymph. That could be represented by this piece of paper right here. All right, so I can move it around on the table. And then the organ for spinning acceleration or angular acceleration is this thing right here. It's called the crista ampullaris with these hair cells. All right, so here's the crista ampullaris. Oh, it's labeled nicely on your slide, the crista ampullaris. Okay, so this right here is the crista ampullaris, and it's connected to your head. So as soon as your head starts to move, so does the crista ampullaris. But what about the endolymph? Since it has inertia, it likes to stay put. Okay? Oh, you know what? We got to change the definition. The crista ampullaris is this thing. The endolymph is this fluid that's in my coffee cup. Okay, so here's the fluid. So when you start to spin your head, the crista ampullaris, the paper right here, is going to move. All right? Just like that, back and forth. And Thanksgiving is coming up, and you could set a table with a tablecloth and put a bunch of stuff on the table like plates and silverware and wine glasses and candelabras and all kinds of stuff. And you could do this experiment, okay, at home. And the experiment would be is to move the crista ampullaris or the tablecloth, okay, without disturbing the endolymph, because the endolymph wants to stay stationary, right? So how could you do that? Maybe I'll cheat a little bit and put it over there, because I don't want to have to clean up coffee. But you could take the tablecloth and do what? Pull it out like that. So your head can move, but what about the endolymph? It likes to stay stationary. Okay. So as the crista ampullaris is moving, but the endolymph is stationary, guess what's going to happen? Since the endolymph is stationary, it's going to push on the cupula and bend these hair cells and give your brain the idea that you're spinning in one direction. Okay, because the endolymph is not moving. So now, if you're spinning for a long period of time, all right, so here's the endolymph again. If you start spinning for a long period of time, like 3 or 4 times around, then all of a sudden the endolymph starts to move inside the semicircular canals. All right, so it's going to start to move. I'll start out slow. So it starts to move. Okay, now what happens if you stop suddenly? What happens if you go like this and stop? So here's the crista ampullaris. It stops, but what about all that fluid in your inner ear? It's going to keep moving, right? So we move it and then stop. Oop, good thing it's a spill-proof coffee cup. Okay, it kept moving, okay? And in terms of this endolymph, okay? So once you stop the crista ampullaris from moving, the endolymph is still going to be spinning in the semicircular canals and it's going to push the stereocilia the opposite way. And if you open your eyes, you're going to get that sensation that you're still spinning. Because of that, the endolymph within the semicircular canals has inertia. Since it has been accelerated, it takes a while for it to stop flowing over the cupula. All right, so if you've never done that, I suppose you could do that after class. Okay. All right, so those are the three important senses that I want you to know about. And here is a little cheat sheet Okay. The structures and functions of the special senses of the labyrinth. And the labyrinth is, in particular, the inner ear. Let me move this slider over. Okay, here we go. All right, so what are the three senses? You have hearing. You have static equilibrium, which we call linear acceleration. And then you have kinetic equilibrium, which is for angular acceleration. So this little table is in Blackboard. So what parts of the ear? How many parts does the ear have? It's got three parts. Maybe I'll put this all up on one big screen. Okay, it's got three parts. And those three parts are what? The external ear, middle ear, and internal ear. For hearing, what parts of that of the ear do you need? You need all three. You need the external ear, all right? If that's plugged up, you won't hear anything. You need the middle ear with those auditory ossicles. If they're broken or if they're all crusted over, then you won't be able to hear anything. And of course, you need the inner ear. Okay, and the inner ear, we got to analyze the inner ear to see what parts make up the inner ear. There's a bony labyrinth that we call the cochlea. What does it look like? Looks like a snail, right? And that's just a little bony labyrinth inside the petrous region of the temporal bone. And then inside the cochlea, there's the membranous labyrinth that we call the cochlear duct. It's got the tectorial membrane and the receptor organ. The receptor organ for hearing is the organ of Corti. And then there are some receptor cells that make up the organ of Corti, and those are those hair cells with the stereocilia poking up right onto that tectorial membrane. All right, so that's for hearing. What about static equilibrium? Do you need an external ear? You do not, okay? And you don't need a middle ear either. The only thing you need is the labyrinth, which is the internal ear, and in particular, the vestibule. And the membranous labyrinth inside the vestibule that gives you the sense of linear acceleration is the utricle and saccule. The receptor organ is what we call the maculae, and the cells within the maculae that give you the sense of linear acceleration are hair cells. Same kinds of cells. Then the third sense is kinetic equilibrium. Don't need external, don't need middle ear, but you need the labyrinth or the internal ear, and in particular the semicircular canals. Inside the semicircular canals, there are ducts that we call the semicircular ducts, kind of similar to the cochlear duct right here. And the organ is the crista ampullaris, and the receptor cells that make up the crista ampullaris are, again, hair cells. Okay? So these things can initiate electrical activity in nerves that go to the brain for the sense of hearing and for the sense of equilibrium. And we would call that the vestibulocochlear nerve. It used to be called the auditory nerve, but now it's vestibulocochlear because we know that it contains afferents for hearing as well as equilibrium from the vestibule as well as from the cochlea or the organ of Corti. All right, so that's it for this chapter, all the special senses. That was kind of a fun chapter. Any questions on this? I'll put that away. Okay, so this is just basically what I talked about today. All right, so I'll close that down. And close that down. And then we want to go to endocrine system. And I've got to find some pictures of the endocrine system. We go back to 1 and 2. Okay, so the endocrine system is sort of like the nervous system because it helps control various functions in your body. All right, the nervous system is characterized as being able to transmit information long distances very rapidly in your body. right? Maybe from the tip of your toe all the way up to the brain in less than a second, right? So that you can have good communication with your big toe. The endocrine system can travel long distances as well for control, but it takes longer for signals to get from one part of the body to the other, okay? And the contrast there is that the nervous system will have an effect for only a short period of time, and then it will have to resend the signal. So the nervous system is fast, but the duration is a short period of time. The endocrine system takes a while to send a signal from one part of your body to another, but that signal will persist for a long period of time. So for long-term control of your body, the endocrine system is really important. For short-term, rapid control of your body, the nervous system is what's important. And the endocrine system is composed of certain kinds of glands. And I think you're pretty much aware of that. We've talked about that already. And these are what we call ductless glands. They don't have a duct. What do we call a gland that has a duct? That's called an exocrine gland. For instance, like a salivary gland is an exocrine duct. A salivary gland produces saliva and it ends up in your mouth because it hops a ride on a duct that takes it exactly right into your mouth. Okay, an endocrine gland secretes a product, but not into a duct, secretes it into the extracellular space, and there it diffuses through a capillary into the blood. And once it's in the blood, where does it go? It goes everywhere in your body. So the endocrine system doesn't use a duct because it uses a cardiovascular system to transport that signaling compound all over your body. So we say the endocrine system is made up of ductless glands that secrete signaling compounds, signaling messenger molecules that we call hormones. So only the endocrine system will secrete a hormone. But it has to be picked up, okay, by the circulatory system, where it travels to a distant target tissue and it elicits a specific response. So it's going to change the behavior of some kind of target tissue. Right, and the hormone is really the only thing that can change the behavior of these cells. So a target tissue has to have something that makes it aware of that particular hormone. Does anybody know what a target tissue has to have in order for it to be controlled by a hormone? Okay, just like in your eye, in order for you to perceive light, what do you have to have? A photoreceptor. Right? And in order for you to perceive temperature on your body, you need a thermoreceptor. And in order for you to appreciate for certain cells, target tissues, to know if a hormone is present or not, they have to have a receptor. That's what makes them a target tissue. All right, so a target tissue has to have a receptor. All right, so some functions of the endocrine system. It regulates relatively slow processes, like we said, but the duration of that control is long-term. Okay, so it can control growth and metabolism, the reproductive system, blood chemistry, and even your immune system are all regulated by endocrine glands when they secrete hormones. So here's a list of 10 endocrine organs in your body, and we probably could come up with some more. The slide on the right shows where some of these organs are, starting with the pituitary gland. Right underneath the hypothalamus, connected to the hypothalamus via the infundibulum. You might want to know something about that. All right, so the hypothalamus is also an endocrine part of your body. That's part of the brain itself because it releases a couple hormones. So it releases these compounds, ADH and oxytocin. They get picked up by the blood and they're carried everywhere in the body. Some other glands, thyroid glands. Okay, the thymus gland helps regulate your immune system. Then we have the adrenal glands right here that control all kinds of different things in your body, like glucose metabolism and salt metabolism. The pancreas, important because it helps regulate the concentration of something really important in your blood. Does anybody know what the pancreas helps regulate in your blood? Blood sugar levels or blood glucose levels. And when people can't regulate blood glucose levels, one of the causes could be damage to the pancreas right here because it's not secreting one of the important hormones. And then we've got a couple of gonads here. All right, well, this looks like a male to me, and a male is going to have a testes. Right, that's a gonad. A gonad in a female is an ovary. So that's kind of a misdrawing because this guy's not going to have an ovary. Okay. And the jobs of these gonads right here are couplefold. They secrete sex steroids, like in the male is going to secrete testosterone, the ovary is going to secrete estrogen and progesterone in the female. But a gonad also has one other important function, and that is that it produces gametes, or sex cells. And the gamete that a testes produces is a sperm, and a gamete that an ovary produces is an egg cell. Okay, and that's how all of us got here at one point in time, is when a sperm cell fertilized an egg cell and created you. Right? And maybe at one point in time you had a mom and a dad, maybe not anymore, or maybe you were conceived in a test tube, I'm not really sure, you don't have to tell anybody, but at one point in time you were a sperm and an egg that joined together. All right, some other endocrine glands inside your body that are not commonly recognized, but they are important endocrine glands, the heart, the digestive tract, the kidneys, and even the skin secrete signaling compounds that control other organs in your body. Most glands are epithelial in origin. They come from epithelium. They don't come from muscle, don't come from nervous tissue. That's not always true, but in most cases that's true. But some can be derived from neurons, like those within the hypothalamus are true neurons that release ADH and oxytocin, muscle cells, and fibroblast-like cells. Then connective tissues can release certain kinds of signaling compounds. All right, so let's talk about some of these signaling compounds. Let me see what this next slide looks like. Okay. Different classes of hormones. And remember, a hormone is just a chemical compound that's secreted by a ductless gland. And if it doesn't have a duct, how does a hormone get to its target tissue? It hops a ride in the bloodstream, right? It gets absorbed into the blood. Blood carries it everywhere in the body. Okay, there are some that are amino acids, and these are based, these are like polypeptides or very small kinds of proteins. And then there are some that are steroids, and a steroid is a lipid. Lipids don't like to dissolve in water. They like to dissolve in fat. We have plenty of fat in our body, okay, but we're mostly water. And steroids are all derived from this lipid here that we call cholesterol. So you probably know that having too much cholesterol is bad for you, but having none probably would even be worse because you couldn't make any steroids. And some of the steroids would be like testosterone, estrogen, progesterone, but others like aldosterone and cortisol. So we're going to talk about some of these things. All right, so let's talk about three main ways that hormone secretion is controlled. And the three ways are humoral, neural, and hormonal control. Humoral, this is the simplest kind of endocrine control mechanism, and that is that the hormone is secreted in direct response to a changing ion or nutrient level in the blood. So this gland is monitoring, it has chemoreceptors for a particular molecule. And for instance, the parathyroid gland in the neck. Here are the parathyroid glands. Here and here, they're embedded in the thyroid gland, and the thyroid gland, maybe from the previous slide, you know, is kind of underneath your Adam's apple. Okay, it responds to a decline in calcium, right? And so it releases parathyroid hormone. Parathyroid hormone then will help dissolve your bones to put calcium back in your blood. Now, you might not like that, because what would you like to have? Really nice, strong bones, right? But calcium is important for many other important functions in your body. Can you think of any other important functions in your body that calcium ions are important for? For synaptic transmission, for instance, for how neurons communicate with each other. So what would be more important, to have a functioning nervous system or to have strong bones? Yeah, much better to have a functioning nervous system than strong bones. Sorry to tell you that. Okay, and calcium also is necessary for muscle contraction, including your diaphragm, which is necessary for breathing. So if, again, you had to choose, would you want to have strong bones or would you like to be able to contract skeletal muscle and breathe? Probably breathing and contraction of skeletal muscle would be more important than to have strong bones, and your body makes that same decision too, which is why, as we get older, what happens to our bones? Well, yeah, they become a little bit more brittle because we lose calcium. Unless we have the proper diet when we're young and exercise to build those bones up, osteoporosis will affect all of us to some degree or another in here. Now, what's the proper diet? Y'all know what exercise is. But what's the proper diet? A diet that is high in calcium, so it has to have calcium ions. But in order to absorb that calcium into your body, you need vitamin D. So you need vitamin D and calcium and exercise to protect yourself from osteoporosis. All right, so this would be an example of a humoral stimulus. That just means that there is calcium in the blood that will stimulate these parathyroid glands. All right, another kind of control is neural, which we see on this slide right here in the middle part, where there is a sympathetic nerve, and here is the lateral horn and gray matter of the thoracolumbar region of the spinal cord, leaves the ventral root, goes all the way to the adrenal medulla, where it releases a neurotransmitter, namely acetylcholine, and it causes these cells of the adrenal medulla to secrete epinephrine and norepinephrine. So these chromaffin cells of the adrenal medulla are acting like the postganglionic cell in an autonomic outflow pathway, but they're also an endocrine gland because these signaling compounds, epinephrine and norepinephrine, are picked up by a capillary distributed everywhere in your body. All right, so this is a good example. The adrenal medulla is an endocrine gland, right? And maybe even better, we could say that it's what a neuroendocrine gland, because it's under neural control, namely the preganglionic fiber. Okay, and then the last kind is hormonal control, where a endocrine gland receives stimuli from other kinds of endocrine glands to control their activity. So certain hormone signals, secretion of hormones from other glands. A really good example of this is when hormones from the hypothalamus are released, right? And these are hormones because they're picked up by a circulatory system that takes it to the anterior pituitary. The hormones then move out of the blood and signal various cells within the anterior pituitary to release even other kinds of hormones, like thyroid hormone, or adrenal corticotropic hormone. I don't think I want to bore you with a really long list of hormones, but the anterior pituitary releases hormones that get picked up by the blood that carry it to various organs that maintain the health and function of other endocrine glands in your body, like the thyroid gland and adrenal cortex and a gonad. Okay, so this would be a good example of hormonal control. The hypothalamus hormonally controlling the anterior pituitary, but also the anterior pituitary hormonally controlling such other organs like the thyroid gland and adrenal cortex and a gonad right here. Okay, so now that I've got your attention with this pituitary, let's take a look at this pituitary gland. And we see that it is not just one color. It's got two main colors to it. And I don't really care what the colors are, but the dark color is the anterior part, and this lighter color is the posterior part. So the pituitary has got these two main parts to it, anterior and posterior. And you can see this blood vessel is going to the anterior pituitary. And the posterior pituitary here has the same color as the brain. And indeed, this is an important distinction because the posterior pituitary really is part of the brain. It's really neuronal tissue. But the anterior part is glandular tissue, right, which actually came from epithelium from the roof of your mouth during development. So even though it's one organ, the pituitary gland, it has a lot of different components to it. And these things secrete different kinds of hormones. All right, so let's take a look. Pituitary gland secretes 9 major hormones in the body. So, here's that pituitary gland in the cella turcica. Here's a nice sphenoid paranasal sinus, right? Here is the little infundibulum coming down from the hypothalamus. Probably should be aware of some of these things already, especially if you've had lab, right? Here's a nice infundibulum, hypothalamus. Okay, so what do I want you to know about this pituitary? Well, I want you to know the anterior pituitary from the posterior pituitary, and of course the infundibulum, which connects it to the hypothalamus. Right? Another name for the infundibulum is the stalk of the pituitary, or pituitary stalk. Right? The adenohypophysis. Hypophysis just means pituitary gland. That's just another name for pituitary. It means below the hypothalamus. This anterior part, we said, was glandular tissue, and so it is also called the adenohypophysis. Anytime you hear adeno, that means glandular type tissue. So adenohypophysis is the anterior lobe, and it contains glandular tissue. The neurohypophysis is the posterior lobe, and it's an extension of the brain joining the anterior lobe. All right, so that's the level that I want you to know. I don't think I want you to know anything about the pars tuberalis or intermedius or distalis. I want you to know anterior from posterior. Anterior is glandular tissue. Posterior is neuronal tissue. That will help you with your understanding. Here I see the optic chiasma, just anterior to the infundibulum, and then posterior to the infundibulum is the mammillary body. Okay, you'll be aware of that as time goes on, especially after lab. All right, well, let's concentrate our thoughts on the anterior lobe. Okay, the anterior lobe secretes a number of hormones right here. And remember, a hormone gets picked up by the blood and distributed everywhere in the body. Right? And some of these hormones are growth hormones. Sometimes we call that somatotropin because it stimulates body growth, muscle growth, bone growth. So that's important during development in order for you to reach your normal potential height. Thyroid stimulating hormone. So here's a hormone from the anterior pituitary, which gets picked up by the blood. And what's the target tissue for thyroid stimulating hormone? And what does it do? What's the target tissue for thyroid stimulating hormone from the anterior pituitary? It is the thyroid gland, right? And it causes the thyroid gland to grow and be maintained and secrete hormones itself, like thyroid hormone. Adrenal corticotropic hormone, or we just abbreviate it ACTH, released by the anterior pituitary. It goes to the adrenal cortex and maintains the health and function of the adrenal cortex and causes secretion of a couple hormones, a couple classes of hormones. And these help you cope with stress via glucose metabolism. Right. Melanocyte-stimulating hormone, MSH. Right. It works as an appetite suppressant in people, but we're still learning a lot about melanocyte-stimulating hormone. Gonadotropins. There are two gonadotropins that are released by the anterior pituitary, and they stimulate, they maintain the health and the growth of gonads. What can you tell me about gonads right now? What's a gonad? It's either testes or an ovary, and they produce gametes or sex cells, right, for reproductive purposes, sexual reproduction. The two gonadotropins that are necessary are follicle-stimulating hormone, and the second one is luteinizing hormone. Let's talk about luteinizing hormone first. And again, these are all from the anterior pituitary. Luteinizing hormone in the female, ooh, the very last topic here, causes ovulation. It causes an egg to be expelled from the ovary so that fertilization can take place. It gets expelled from the ovary and then starts its travels down the fallopian tube toward the uterus. So that's the job of LH. Well, ovulation never takes place in a male because sperm are produced all the time and they just leave the testes on their own free will. So there's no such thing as luteinizing hormone for spermatogenesis. But in the male, it performs an important function because it stimulates the production of testosterone and also the release of testosterone from a testes. Right? And testosterone is the male sex steroid. All right, so LH is a little bit different in male and female. Follicle-stimulating hormone, or FSH, is pretty similar in the male and the female. In the male, it promotes spermatogenesis, which is the male gamete, the production of sperm cells. And in the female, it supports the maturation of an egg cell within a follicle, which then also produces a gamete. So follicle-stimulating hormone produces gametes, either egg cells or sperm cells. And then lastly, prolactin from the anterior pituitary here is released, and in particular, it's released during gestation, and it promotes the development of the glandular tissue of the breast so that the breast can produce a competent milk product after parturition. All right, so that's the job of prolactin. It doesn't cause milk letdown reflex, but it just causes the breast to grow and develop its glandular tissue in order to produce milk. All right, let's see what kind of next slide I have. Okay, I want to say one last thing about this anterior pituitary with this slide right here. So the hypothalamus controls the anterior pituitary. So here is the hypothalamus, and here are some neurons. And the neurons end right here within the stalk of the pituitary gland or the infundibulum. And so action potentials, nerve impulses reach these axon terminals, and then these axon terminals release what we call a releasing factor that gets picked up by this first capillary system, takes it through this blood vessel directly to the anterior pituitary. So this is a direct delivery system so that the hormones released from the hypothalamus don't get diluted through the whole circulation. They go directly to the anterior pituitary, and they can leak out of these capillaries and stimulate the cells of the anterior pituitary. So here are the hormones of the anterior pituitary. The names of the hormones released by the hypothalamus that go through this hypophyseal portal vein. Hypophyseal just means that it's a pituitary gland. And a portal blood vessel, I'll have to mention this again a number of times, a portal blood vessel is a blood vessel between two capillary beds. And that's a relatively rare occurrence in our cardiovascular system. Usually blood comes from the heart to one capillary bed and then it returns to the heart. But here, it's a special delivery system, so blood comes from the heart, goes to one capillary, and then it recoalesces into a blood vessel, which then takes it to a second capillary bed before it goes back to the heart. So a portal blood vessel has two capillary beds back to back instead of just one, as in the usual circulation. All right, so the hormones from the hypothalamus that cause the release of anterior pituitary hormones are called releasing factors. So the releasing factor from the hypothalamus that causes the release of TSH is called TSH-RF. The name of ACTH releasing factor, right, the hormone that causes the release of ACTH from the anterior pituitary, right, comes from the hypothalamus through this portal blood vessel, is called ACTH-RF. Each one is just given that extra little name, releasing factors. So releasing factors come from the hypothalamus causing the release of hormones from the anterior pituitary. Okay, let's go on to the posterior lobe. So here's the posterior lobe. Notice that this portal blood vessel doesn't go to the posterior lobe, it only goes to the anterior lobe. So how is it that the posterior lobe can secrete hormones? And that's because it has axons coming all the way from the hypothalamus, and the axon terminus is in the posterior pituitary. And part of the infundibulum is a tract. A tract, remember, it just contains myelinated axons that are going someplace. They're going between the hypothalamus and posterior pituitary. Here's a nucleus within the hypothalamus. Here's a second nucleus. Remember, a nucleus is just a group of nerve cell bodies and dendrites within the central nervous system, and they look dark because they're not myelinated. They're non-myelinated fibers. These two nuclei are the paraventricular nucleus because they're on either side within of the third ventricle. Then the supraoptic nucleus is in the hypothalamus, just superior to the optic chiasma. So that's why it got its name. All right, so when these neurons become stimulated, it sends action potentials down through the tract, the hypothalamic hypophyseal tract. And remember, a tract is what, myelinated fibers in the central nervous system going someplace. When those nerve impulses reach the axon terminus, then it causes the release of something that looks like a neurotransmitter into the extracellular space. But that neurotransmitter gets picked up by the circulatory system and gets delivered everywhere in the body. So those really aren't neurotransmitters, those really are hormones, right? Because it gets picked up by the circulatory system, right? But they really are neurotransmitters because they're being secreted by a neuron. So people then come to realize that that signaling compound really is what we call a neurohormone, because it's released by a neuron, but it gets delivered by the cardiovascular system. It has characteristics of both being like a transmitter and a hormone, so we like to combine those terms. The two hormones, or the two neurohormones from the posterior pituitary, and there's only two, thank goodness, are oxytocin and antidiuretic hormone. What does a diuretic do? A diuretic makes your kidneys produce copious amounts of very dilute urine, right? Makes you pee. That's what a diuretic does. And antidiuretic does what? The opposite. It helps you conserve water. It makes your kidneys make very small amounts of very concentrated urine so that your body can retain water. That's what antidiuretic hormone does. Oxytocin is an important smooth muscle stimulant. So when it's in the circulatory system, it causes smooth muscles to contract, particularly or notably the uterus, which is made up of smooth muscle. And oxytocin is at very high levels during parturition, when the uterus contracts for childbirth. Okay. Oxytocin also causes smooth muscle around the glandular tissue of the breast to contract, and it produces the milk letdown reflex. All right, so oxytocin in general stimulates smooth muscles to contract. Two good examples of this, one would be parturition. The second example would be the milk letdown reflex after parturition. Okay, and there's a related hormone from the anterior pituitary, we call that prolactin, that has to be available to the anterior pituitary during gestation so that oxytocin can stimulate the milk letdown reflex. Okay, sometimes antidiuretic hormone is called vasopressin because it helps maintain blood pressure as well, because it helps you retain fluids. So anything that helps you retain fluids or maintains your fluid level will have a tendency to increase your blood pressure. And I think you could just think of your tires on your car, right? If there's too much pressure in the tires in your car, what do? Take air out or put air in? If there's too much pressure in your tires, you take air out. But if there's not enough pressure in your tires, what do? You put air in. Same thing, that's what your body does. When your blood pressure is too low, it keeps fluids inside your body that maintains your blood pressure, and when your blood pressure is too high, right, then you'll produce a lot of urine lowering your blood pressure. All right, so that's part of the job of antidiuretic hormone. The thyroid gland. All right, here's a thyroid gland. Here's your Adam's apple. We call that the larynx, and here's your windpipe. We call that the trachea. We're going to look at that pretty soon. And on either side, there's this butterfly-shaped organ. That's the thyroid gland. That's in your anterior neck. All right, it's the largest pure endocrine gland. It produces two hormones, thyroid hormone, okay, and thyroid hormone has two different forms. It's called T3 and T4, and that's because thyroid hormone, in order to be competent, it has to have an iodine molecule put on it. T3 has three iodine molecules added to it, and T4 has, take a guess, four. That's right. Okay, the most active form is triiodothreonine, which is T3, and we just usually say T3 and T4 because tetraiodothreonine is just too difficult to say when you're in a hurry. Right? Same thing with triiodothreonine, just too long of a word. All right, so both of these are thyroid hormones. The second hormone that's produced is called calcitonin. Right? It decreases blood concentration of calcium. So when your blood concentration of calcium goes to high, maybe you drank like 20 milkshakes or something because you really like milkshakes, and all of a sudden you have this big load of calcium in your body, the thyroid gland releases calcitonin, and that promotes the uptake of calcium from the blood into bones and other kinds of tissues, thus lowering blood calcium levels. All right, that happens right here in the thyroid gland. Associated with the thyroid gland, and we talked about these, are the parathyroid glands, these little nodules right here on the posterior part of the thyroid gland. These are also important for regulating blood calcium levels. Right? They produce parathyroid hormone, or PTH, right? And these will increase blood calcium levels. For instance, when your diet is really low on calcium, you haven't had any milkshakes today, and your blood calcium starts to decrease, well, your body says, hey, we need to maintain blood calcium levels. Let's go to bone and dissolve some bone away to put that calcium back into the blood. That's the job of parathyroid hormone from the parathyroid glands. All right, so what could you tell me? What's the action of calcitonin versus parathyroid hormone? They're antagonistic to each other, right? And, of course, you shouldn't get your feelings hurt about that. That means what in terms of a control system? Precise control and balance. So you have precise control and balance over your blood calcium levels because of the interaction between these two antagonistic hormones. Very important. Okay. The adrenal glands. And as far as this antagonism goes, right, we looked at it in terms of the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system, in terms of the musculoskeletal system. So here's an example of the endocrine system that uses antagonistic control. All right, let's go to the adrenal gland. So here's a kidney. Kidneys are just right above your belly button, but they're way posterior. They're in your back. And then on top of the kidneys are what we call the adrenal glands. Sometimes they're called the suprarenal glands. And the suprarenal glands have two parts. There's a superficial part that we call the cortex, and then the deep part is what we call the medulla. And that's the case for every organ in your body. The superficial part is the cortex, the deep part is the medulla. We talked about the medulla already because it acts like a postganglionic sympathetic neuron. It releases norepinephrine and epinephrine into the blood. But the cortex is a lot different. It has all these different layers in it. And the adrenal cortex secretes steroid hormones or lipid-based hormones based on cholesterol. And there are two kinds of adrenal cortical steroids. There are mineralocorticoids, which help regulate mineral metabolism in your body, like sodium and potassium, and glucocorticoids that help regulate something else in your blood. Not minerals, but sugars. That's right, glucose. Okay, from glucocorticoids. Do I give you any examples? Yeah, I gave you a couple of one example. A mineralocorticoid would be aldosterone. It's secreted in response to decline in blood pressure or blood volume, and so it has a tendency for you to retain salt. And when you retain salt, you retain water. That's like putting air in your tire. What happens to pressure then in your tire if you put air in? It goes up, right? So aldosterone is important for maintaining blood pressure. And since it's a hormone, it maintains blood pressure in the long term, not from second to second or minute to minute, but from day to day or week to week, months to months. Okay, the other kind of glucocorticoid is cortisol. Helps the body deal with stressful situations by mobilizing glucose, maintaining blood glucose levels. Okay, and they're produced, these different hormones are produced by these different layers of the adrenal cortex. Not on the slide right here, there's another hormone that's being produced by one of these layers right here, and that is testosterone. So both males and females have testosterone in their body because we all have what, an adrenal cortex. And testosterone is important because it produces a sex drive in people. And without a sex drive, there would be no procreation, there would be no perpetuation of the species. Okay, as well as aggressive behavior as well. So females can exhibit aggressive behavior because of testosterone from the adrenal cortex. Okay, pineal gland. Where the heck is that pineal gland at? Maybe some of you can remember where pineal gland is from lab. Oh, I'm going to go back. Okay, pineal gland is way back over here. So here's the pituitary. Pineal gland is way posterior, inferior to the corpus callosum. Okay, it's located on the roof of the diencephalon. It's kind of shaped like a pine cone. Maybe some of you that saw it this morning can kind of recognize that. And it secretes melatonin. And it's a hormone that regulates circadian rhythms or other kinds of rhythms that take place in our body. Circadian rhythm just means day and night cycle. Some people are more day people. Some people are morning people, afternoon people. And it might be due to this hormone right here, melatonin. It also helps you sleep. So if somebody has a sleep disturbance, it might be due to some disturbance within the pineal gland and the hormone that it's secreting. And as a matter of fact, some people take melatonin to help them sleep. I don't know if that's warranted or not. But I think you can find melatonin in health food stores. Probably you can't get a prescription from a physician for it. The pancreas. So here's the pancreas, one of the last organs that we're going to look at. So it's located in the posterior abdominal wall. It contains both endocrine and exocrine cells. So there's a duct that goes through the pancreas that secretes exocrines, namely digestive enzymes. And those digestive enzymes go through the duct in the pancreas and they're emptied into the digestive system, namely the small intestine. That's the exocrine part. The endocrine part are the cells that surround the other cells inside the pancreas. They don't have ducts. Since they don't have ducts, what kind of glandular tissue is that? Since these cells don't have ducts. Yeah, they're endocrine, right? Because it comes from a ductless gland. And they're located around the ducts for the exocrine part of the pancreas. So they're called pancreatic islets, or little islands, or islands of Langerhans. They secrete two hormones, insulin and glucagon. Well, here's gluca in the name of glucagon that should give you a hint as to what is it regulating. Glucose, yeah, as a matter of fact, blood glucose. And I ask you that because it's part of the name, but you've probably heard of this other hormone called insulin. And what is its job? What is it regulating? Blood sugars again, blood glucose levels. All right, so here you have two hormones, both involved with regulating blood glucose. And what kind of scheme have you really realized in this class? What's important for precise control and balance? Antagonistic system, right? So the action of insulin and glucagon are antagonistic to each other. Insulin causes a decrease in blood glucose. Glucagon causes an increase in blood glucose. So when you're in a fed state after eating a meal and glucose is being absorbed by your stomach and intestines and put into your bloodstream, then the pancreas releases insulin so that all the cells in your body can take glucose from the blood. And as glucose leaves the blood, what happens to blood glucose levels? They start to go down. Okay? And that's because cells are taking up glucose. But cells need glucose to stay alive. Right? They can make ATP from that glucose. All right, now when you're in a fasted state, like you've been sleeping all night long for 12 hours, okay, you haven't eaten anything, so no glucose is being absorbed from the digestive tract, so your blood glucose starts to go down. You're fasting. But if your blood glucose goes down too low, then you lose brain function, another function in your body. So here is a hormone that is released from the pancreas, and it goes to the liver. Glucagon goes to the liver, and it tells the liver to break down glycogen. Glycogen is a storage form of glucose. It chops off a glucose, puts it in the blood, and as glucose goes from the liver into the blood, what happens to your blood glucose levels? They start to increase back to normal levels. So insulin decreases, glucagon increases, and when they're working together, even though they're in opposite directions, you have nice, pretty steady blood glucose concentration in your blood, keeping you in a nice, healthy state. All right, so the two kinds of cells in the pancreas that release these antagonistic hormones are the alpha cells and beta cells. The beta cells secrete insulin, and the alpha cells secrete glucagon. And these cells right here actually just monitor blood glucose levels all the time and adjust the secretion depending on what the need is in your body. So glucagon raises blood sugar, insulin lowers blood sugar. So would a diabetic ever give themselves a shot of insulin when they're in a fasted state? No, because that would just drop their blood glucose levels way too drastically. Okay, so somebody that's a diabetic would take an insulin shot to help regulate blood glucose after a meal, for instance, when their blood glucose levels start to increase, so that glucose can enter all the rest of the cells of the body. And indeed, without that insulin present, glucose will be trapped in the blood, will stay very high, and then all of the other cells in their body will start to starve to death as a result. So it's really important. If you know anybody that has problems regulating glucose because they have diabetes mellitus, right, it's really important to control that disease process so all those cells in their body don't starve to death. especially the kidney and the retina, okay, and other highly metabolic parts of the body. Okay, gonads. Right, we've got some gonads here, ovaries and testes, main source of sex steroids. Okay, except for the adrenal cortex, and females can secrete remarkable amounts of testosterone. Right, the cells for the male are the interstitial cells of the testes. I don't know if I have a picture of interstitial cells or not. Let's see. Well, a testes has a lot of tubes in it. The tubes make sperm, and between the tubes are what we call interstitial cells. And when we get to reproductive chapter, I can show you, but I don't have a picture right now. Right, these interstitial cells secrete androgens like testosterone. And these are the cells that have receptors for LH from the anterior pituitary. So luteinizing hormone from the anterior pituitary will cause or stimulate these interstitial cells to secrete testosterone. Right, and then testosterone is secreted from the testes, and it helps promote the formation of sperm or spermatogenesis. So spermatogenesis is dependent on testosterone. And testosterone also maintains secondary sex characteristics. Like, what's a secondary sex characteristic? And we're talking about a male. Okay? Will be more and coarser hair all over your body. Bigger, thicker bones. More musculature. Bigger, stronger muscles. Right? A bigger windpipe, which means then that males' voices are typically what? Lower in frequency because their larynx is larger, vibrates at a lower frequency. Right? Testosterone also maintains, for instance, like the penis right here, some other important secondary sex characteristics. Okay, female in the ovaries, right, secrete two hormones. Remember, the male only secretes one, testosterone. But in the female, we're going to talk about these two toward the end of this semester, which feels like it's going to happen like later this week. Okay, there are two. There's estrogen and progesterone. Estrogen maintains secondary sex characteristics. It helps promote follicle development and gametogenesis, oogenesis. Progesterone prepares the uterus for pregnancy and helps maintain pregnancy. What's a term for pregnancy? What's a term for pregnancy? How about gestation? Gestation is a fancy word for when somebody's pregnant, right? Because the fetus is developing in utero. So progesterone is built upon that term, gestation. So progesterone is really what? Progestational hormone. This is a hormone that has to be at a high level during gestation, and that will maintain pregnancy. When progesterone decreases, that's a signal in the female body that there is no pregnancy. Okay, so progesterone is high during possible pregnancy, certainly during pregnancy, and low otherwise. All right, so that's the endocrine chapter. All right, so endocrines are ductless glands. They secrete something called hormones. How do these hormones get around in your body? Through the cardiovascular system. They leak out, can stimulate a target tissue if a target tissue has what? A receptor. And that target tissue then will produce a specific response to that hormone. And it's usually only that hormone that can make that cell behave that way. So we call it a specific response. And the sign-in sheet is going around. Oh, the microphone did turn off, didn't it?